Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim. I'm here in the studio with Andy Steiger and Chris Battle, as usual.
Greetings. It's good to be with you.
We're actually in a studio in this small little room with soundproof material and two microphone setups. So you can probably hear that we're going stereo now.
It's pretty professional.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah, pretty hardcore. Thank you, Steve Kim.
I actually didn't set this up. I set up like this when I came in, so thank whoever set this up before us, and we'll probably follow this trend from now on because this is awesome. So yes, we're actually in a studio today. So we're going to continue on with World Religions series, where we talked about Buddhism last time, and we're going to continue to do that today. But as usual, we're going to start with a bit of cultural commentary. And you probably have seen this on social media all over the place about Planned Parenthood and how, allegedly at least, Planned Parenthood seems to be selling body parts of fetuses that they've aborted.
Had you guys ever heard of this before? Like this idea that...
Selling in body parts?
Yeah, the aborted fetuses.
Like the legitimately, you mean?
Yeah, right. These parts were being sold.
It never even crossed my mind that somebody would think to do that. On second thought, it seems okay. Well, that's the sort of natural outworking of it, right? But
it's pretty horrendous. I mean, do we even know why people would want to buy?
I'm not sure, but apparently people,
there's a demand for it.
I was reading the thing because the actors that were in the video were essentially posing as buyers,
right?
And they would work as sort of either an in between or maybe there's a number of buyers that these people take them and they do either stem cell research or some sort of medical researching in order to make breakthroughs or
and there's
something.
There's actually an order form on this website. I actually went to that website and looked for it, and interestingly enough, that page is shut down. It just says can't find it, or you know, it's busy or whatever. So it's I couldn't bring it up, but I saw the website name from the video, and I actually went to it. So
clearly there was an order form.
Yeah, there was an order form. I mean, I didn't get to verify it myself, but it's a little interesting that, you know, just as this is going out, it seems that, you know, this form isn't working. It'd be interesting to go see if it's working now, because
But nevertheless, it's obvious from the video from the doctor herself that they do take specific orders. Like she talks about huddling up and you know, determining what parts the people need that day, what orders have come through, and so forth, and then going in there with that mindset.
And how they try, you know, they try not to crush the head as they, you know, bring out the head, you know, and so they talked about, you know, how they did it differently. Like, so they would, for example, take the baby, flip it around basically into breech position, so feet comes out first, that causes more dilation, and that way they can bring out the head without crushing it. That sort of, she was actually talking in detail about how they try to preserve some of these body parts.
I actually have the quote here from the transcript, and says, "So when you're just kind of cognizant of where you put your graspers, you try to intentionally go above and below the thorax so that, you know, we've been very good at getting heart, lung, liver, because we know that. So I'm not going to crush that part. I'm going to basically crush below. I'm going to crush above. And I'm going to see if I can get it all intact." And then she goes on to describe what Steve was just talking about as far as the head. Wow. It's sickening.
It's quite disturbing. Yeah.
So there's a lot of outrage, obviously, over this right now out there. And some people are calling for action on this. Namely, you know, talk to your congressman or whatever to pull funding from Planned Parenthood. So there's a lot of outrage out there right now. Mm-hmm. But let's just get some of your thoughts on this. In terms of its sort of, I guess, metaphysics or what have you, or the moral aspect to it, or because there's always something brewing in the minds of Chris Battle and Andy Steiger.
I'll go last because I'm gonna bring up one other thing.
Well, to me, I mean, just the most obvious thing is just the preciousness of human life, and to hear her so cavalierly discuss the snuffing of it out and describing aspects of our personhood in a sense, right? Because we're inextricably linked to our bodies. God's given us these vehicles made in his image, obviously not the physical body aspect to it, but he's provided us with these vehicles. And her so cavalierly discussing how she dismembers this little baby in order to provide somebody else with a means to do research or whatever that they're doing it for. So just morally, from a made in the image of God point of view, it is disturbing, because she's talking about it as if it's merely a means to an end. Mm-hmm. It is completely, it's in her mind, it's not a little person that she's cutting up. It's a little science experiment, or it's a little thing.
Notice why they'll refer to it as a fetus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's another way of dehumanizing this baby.
Yeah.
Right. So I it's interesting to me, because yesterday on Facebook, a friend of mine who happens to be an atheist, he posted something. Now, I didn't read this article, but he was basically attacking the feminist movement. He's not a very big fan of feminists, which is a bit of an odd combination, because usually I find that atheists are also very pro-women in that sense, like feminist sense.
Mm-hmm.
But he was basically saying, you see, feminists, this is what it leads to. You know, like, why are you not okay with this? Right? I mean, I haven't read the article, but from there I got the sense that apparently a lot of people who are, quote, pro-choicers, I like to call them pro-abortionists, but even these people are getting disturbed by what they're seeing. So there is that intuitive recognition that this is whatever is growing, whether it's part of the mother or what have you, whatever this is more than just a glob of tissue. Mm-hmm. There is something precious in there, and I think we all recognize it. I think that's why there's such an outrage out there.
And really, there should be an outrage, shouldn't there? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think we've lost sight of the fact that they're killing babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that we forget that we are a part of a culture that doesn't respect human life in the most precious form, and that we're willing to crush, murder, you know, in the most gruesome of manner, and now in such a way that we can keep what we want of the body, you know, and that we're willing to kill these children. It's quite disturbing.
In a lot of ways, I think this is our Holocaust in the West.
I've heard it described like that before.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of leads into something that I wanted to tap into. And that is in one of the most recent editions of The Economist. It's hard to keep up with them. They seem to publish something about once a week. their head cover, the cover and the main title of it was The Right to Die. Mm. And I thought this was interesting. It was Why Assisted Suicide Should Be Legal. Now, what I think is interesting in how these two connect is one of their main arguments with the right to die is that everyone's worried about the slippery slope, right? We don't want to open up this you know, door, because who knows where it's going to lead. And then, so throughout this article, and they wrote on it in many places in the magazine and in different ways, but they keep coming back to this idea. You know, look, Oregon has these laws and other European nations has these, you know, laws that allow for a physician-assisted suicide. And it hasn't, you know, led to anything more.
Yeah.
So thus it must be.
Must be okay.
It must be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's their logic, which I find really disturbing, because what we know is when you do open these doors, whether they be abortion or physician-assisted suicide, once your moral framework has shifted, it is only a matter of time until you do go down that slippery slope, and that all of a sudden a baby's body parts now has monetary value,
mm-hmm.
right? And now all of a sudden we've gone from, oh, this, you know, this woman has this choice, you know, to this baby actually has you know, monetary value, and now there's added incentive to kill. Now this is kind of interesting, because this is part of the whole argument that's going on with assisted suicide, is You know, what kind of doors get opened up once we allow for killing, right? Whether that's a baby or that's an adult. And that was another question that comes is, so can a 5-year-old ask to die, you know, or a 95-year-old ask to die? You know, who's allowed to die and who's not allowed to die? And for what reasons can you die and what reasons can you not? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find so interesting and disturbing is that The Economist and others else we see in our day want to argue so much for this right to die, and they want to focus so much on death. It's fascinating to me that we don't focus on life and living and what's causing death and seeking to put more, like, shouldn't this like invigorate us to want to fight cancer, for example, you know, instead of giving up and just saying, well, if you get cancer, well, you know, it's pretty expensive, mm-hmm. you know, and painful. And do we want to go through all that? And, you know, maybe it's easier if we just euthanize people.
Yeah. In other words, the person is now getting reduced down to his or her economic value or contribution to the society rather than the person. Because we've lost sight of personhood, right? We've lost sight of that essence, what makes a person a person.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it, Steve. We're seeing it on both ends, mm-hmm. where this baby's becoming monetized and this adult is becoming monetized. Mm-hmm. And this concerns me.
I think the next logical step in that slippery slope, too, is when people... Because if a person can, say, prove that, okay, I have the right to die because of such and such a reason, well, what happens when all of a sudden the state or family members or something like that, they can make that case for you?
That's right.
They can set a precedent, like, okay, say this person said they should be able to die because of this reason, and now, okay, well, Andy, you know, you're my grandpa and you've been sticking around a little bit too long and you're eating away at my inheritance, and I have a precedent of this guy taking his own life. I'm going to take his reasoning, apply it to you, take it to the courts, and the courts are going to go, well, why not, right? Like, he's got a point. All right, take your grandpa back, and do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. that seems to me to be the logical outworking of that. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, as you sort of alluded to, we're going to start, it seems, to have state-sponsored euthanasia. Down the road, obviously, we need to get desensitized to where we're at the moment. Mm-hmm. But,
and I think this is something that just people who are listening to just be cognizant of. I think it can be so easy to get wooed, you know, if you will, into some of the logic, you know, because you'll go, well, it makes intuitive sense. Like, if somebody's in a lot of pain, mm-hmm. right, and we know they're going to die from this cancer, and we're making them spend the remaining month of their life, you know, in intense pain, and they always use, you know, the exaggerated example, right. You know, well, then shouldn't they be allowed to die, kind right. of thing.
I think whenever we hear an argument, we try to understand it naturally. I find this is my case, at least. And in trying to understand the argument, I tend to get very tunnel vision because I'm focusing just on that, and I forget to kind of take into account this other considerations that come into it. So I just want to encourage our listeners, whenever you listen to an argument and you're trying to understand it, just be cognizant that you might be getting tunnel visioned, mm-hmm. and there might be a lot of other examples, other cases. So just be open-minded about that, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And as Christians, we've got to make our stand that life has value, mm-hmm. and that killing is wrong in any form, and start, you know, really arguing for and standing for life, mm-hmm. in all of its forms.
I agree. Because, I mean, nobody's saying that a person can't die. I mean, when I die, I want to go see Jesus, right? So I'm pretty excited about it, but I want to go, quote-unquote, naturally or as my time. I don't want to be... I don't think I have the right to decide to take my own life or to put that in your hands. I mean, if I'm on life support and you pull the plug and I pass away, that's fine, right? That's, you know, that's time to go. But if it's assisted, I think that's where it crosses the line, right. And becomes murder.
There is a in the recent Apologetics Canada conference in Toronto, one breakout session was on that very topic, and that will be up on the store page
pretty soon. So it's only going to be $1 just to cover our costs, so whatever. So if you're interested in that topic and you want to hear more about it, I think Ewan did a pretty good job of covering that topic. Now,
yeah, there's also a book that I would recommend called Moral Choices.
By Scott Ray.
Mm-hmm. And he covers a vast array of different topics, this being one of them.
Right. Okay, speaking of people and their value and our view of humanity, we wanted to talk a little bit more about Buddhism and their core tenets and whatnot. So, Andy, do you want to kind of introduce us to some of their core teachings?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this last time, mm-hmm. so this will just be a reminder.
Right.
If you remember, I told you the analogy of the ocean that was given to me by a Buddhist monk, actually a Pure Land Buddhist monk. And just the idea that there is this ocean of oneness that exists, this impersonal force of which we're all a part of, and that if an ego or an I can form out of this oneness, again, it's not explained how that can happen, but that they believe it can happen if you begin to desire. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to desire, you begin to separate yourself from the oneness and you begin to suffer. And so you have to understand, I mean, let's think about this question. What would be the meaning of life according to a Buddhist?
The meaning of life, I would say, is, well, I guess the purpose of life, if you want to frame it that way, is to go back to the state that you should have been all along, which is to be one with
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Reality.
Yeah, so that would be the purpose, is to get back to that impersonal oneness. And so if you want to do that, if you want to achieve, you know, quote unquote, the purpose of life, although philosophically speaking, that we couldn't.
Yeah.
That's a discussion for another day.
Whole other topic.
But if that's the case, what you need to do then is you need to stop desiring. And if you can stop desiring, then you'll stop suffering. And you'll stop suffering because you'll go back into this oneness. Now, this gets fascinating, though, because, I mean, think about that for a moment. Can you stop desiring? And think about all that entails. I was talking to a former Buddhist, actually, from Cambodia. He's now a pastor. And he was a Buddhist monk for quite some time. And this just racked him. Like, how do I stop desiring? I mean, how do I stop loving my family, my mom, my dad? Mm-hmm. How do I not desire to have kids or my wife?
Was he a Theravada Buddhist? If he's from Cambodia, think so, yeah. And that's the more kind of the rigorous version of it.
They would, yeah, you could consider that the orthodox version
right.
of Buddhism.
But even that desire to want to get back to the oneness, right? There would be a sense of desire to get to there. So how do you eradicate that?
Well, yeah, and that becomes now the circular reasoning in it, right? Is because now you're desiring not to desire.
Mm-hmm. So it's just an infinite regress then, you know, the desire to not to desire to not to desire to not to desire.
Right, which, so on and so forth. Leaving out the whole problem of how do you go from something impersonal or impersonal to something personal?
Mm-hmm.
How do you go from no I to an I? How do you go from no ego to an ego? I mean,
now, as I understand it in Buddhism, the Buddha apparently taught that we don't have a soul. So that's the doctrine of anatman, right? There is no soul. We're basically aggregates of several things like memory, desire, and all of that stuff. So we are actually changing moment by moment. And so the doctrine of impermanence, right? Everything is changing. Everything is transitory. We ourselves are transitory. We are not really,
mm-hmm.
you know, a one essential being. We're aggregates of these things.
Well, that follows from, and I've said this last time, that Buddhism is a helpful way to think of Buddhism is reformed Hinduism. And so the Hindu would say it, that Atman is Brahman and Brahman is Atman.
Now, Atman is the essential self.
Right. Right.
And Brahman is the
impersonal force.
Divine reality, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you have to be so careful, though, right?
Right.
When you say divine reality, because it's so easy to superimpose a Christian worldview on that.
Because we think God.
Yeah, and when we think God, we think personal. Yeah, person. A personal being.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're using a divine force, if you will, You got to remember, it's more of the Star Wars version. Mm-hmm. It's this impersonal force. Yeah, I mean, and so that's where, you know, people can get quite confused when you have so many different idols, you know, and these different, you know, what you might call forms of the god takes. So some people will say that, say, for example, in Hinduism, that they have, you know, 200 million gods. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not necessarily correct. What they have is, maybe you could say, yeah.
Manifestations of
Brahma.
Brahma.
Yeah, so you could say maybe that they've got 200 million different manifestations of Brahman.
Right.
Right.
So in a sense, that almost sounds monotheistic. I mean, if you were to consider Brahman to be some kind of a god.
Right, because they're not polytheistic in the strict sense of the word. However, mm-hmm. this is where you got to be so careful. I've met Hindus mm-hmm. that do have a very, you know, theistic understanding,
right,
and of the world, right. So this happens quite often, either through animism. So they've taken their animistic, you know, spiritual beliefs that are very cultural. Right. In a particular area, oftentimes, and they superimpose those onto their Hinduism. Mm-hmm. So you'll get a mix. We'll often call this folk, you know, Hinduism or folk Islam. Right. You see this in all the religions.
Right. So then, bringing it back to Buddhism, you were saying that it's more like a reformed Hinduism. So then, Buddha rejected the caste system and the Vedic teachings.
Right. Because now this gets into like Hinduism, right? So. How do you get out of mm-hmm. Hinduism? Now, Hinduism plays in... So they're going to come at this from a different perspective. They're going to come at this from karma mm-hmm. and the fact that you suffer because of karma.
What is karma?
And so karma would be the bad things, if you will, that you did in a previous life. Mm-hmm. Well, this raises back to a logical problem, again, is, you know, the not desiring. But this gets into a different problem, and that is, you know, well, what are you reincarnating... What's the first reincarnation from?
Right. Like, mm-hmm. So when you said earlier that this gets into Hinduism, you meant Buddhism.
Sorry, yeah. Yes. Yeah,
into Buddhism. Okay, that makes sense now. Okay.
So for them, they would see this as, for them, their desire for the Hindu is moksha, mm-hmm. which is the liberation from the cycle of samsara, which
reincarnation.
Yeah. And so now that gets interesting too. Some Hindus think that you can get out of the cycle of reincarnation. Some don't. Some mm-hmm. think that you eternally stay into this.
Right, so you get, and throughout the cycle, you get anywhere from like a little piece of rock all the way to God, and then
that's right,
a God. I mean, and then you come back down, go up and down, and that's just this forever.
And this fits into the Hindu caste system, if you will, in the sense mm-hmm. that there are different animals along the journey into getting back to a human. So if you do something really bad in your previous life, I mean, you could be a grasshopper. And that grasshopper is really low on the caste system. Now, there's other animals that you'll find that Hindus worship, like rats, snakes, monkeys, cows. Mm-hmm. Now, cow is the last stop until you become human.
Right.
Now, it's so close to human in places like Nepal, they're going to view a cow on par with a human. So if you hit a cow and kill a cow with your car, it could be just as bad as hitting a person.
Right.
And killing a person with your car. Mm-hmm. So that's the way they understand things. Now, again, although we're talking about Buddhism, you got to know Hinduism mm-hmm. if you're going to understand Buddhism. Right. And you've got to understand that some of what we're talking about with Hinduism has continued on into Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Some of it got dropped by the wayside. So so you'll find these different forms in Buddhism. So you'll find things like reincarnation mm-hmm. in Buddhism. They'll have like these remnants of Hinduism, although strictly speaking, you don't need that to understand the Buddha's teaching.
So, how would the idea of reincarnation work then with the Buddhist concept of not having a personal I that continues, that is constantly being sort of with the ebb and flow, if you will, of the oneness or whatever? Mm-hmm. How does that fit in if you can't have an ongoing person, self mm-hmm. how can you be reincarnated, or who actually is mm-hmm. or what are you paying for, essentially? So in a sense, this has to do
well, the Hindu would say what you're paying for is what they would say that by not understanding your divine nature.
So the problem is ignorance. Then.
That's correct.
Right.
The problem is ignorance, that you that because you don't understand your divine nature, this is what's led you into mm-hmm. your problem. So if you want to get out of this cycle of reincarnation and achieve moksha, mm-hmm. you to do that you need to come to terms with your divine nature.
Right, and it seemed to me like as I was reading about Buddhism, that kind of carried over into Buddhism as well, because
mm-hmm.
Buddha also taught that you need to be enlightened, right? You need to come to understand the true nature of things. The difference was that whereas the Hindus thought, okay, this is all an illusion, Maya, right? This is all an illusion, but behind the veil of illusion, there is that Brahman, there's that ultimate reality. Whereas Buddha said, okay, well, this is all an illusion, sure, but behind the veil is nothing. It's the void. It's the sunyata, right? That's the void.
Impersonal force.
Right.
Yeah.
But from what I was reading, it seemed to me like there wasn't even that almost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was just the void, nothingness.
Again, it would depend upon what Buddhist you're talking to with regards to that. However, you're right in the sense that, and we talked about this last time, nirvana, mm-hmm. you know, the etymology literally means to snuff or to blow out like a candle. It means to cease to exist. Now, different Buddhists are going to understand that differently. So, for example, the former Buddhist that I met, who's now a pastor,
mm-hmm.
he understood that in seeking to stop desiring, that he would go back into that impersonal force, that oneness, and he would lose his personhood.
Right.
Right. And so that, in that sense, he would cease to exist.
In that sense,
it's very. People, Christians, really need to appreciate the idea of how hopeless Buddhism is.
So in that sense, personhood is almost an undesirable outcome.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the ego or the I is a negative thing in Buddhism.
Right. You actually want to cease to exist. It's almost like you are a pest, you know, like that needs to be eliminated.
So you have to understand then that Christianity is completely counter mm-hmm. to that, that the person or the I, your humanity is a good thing.
Imago Dei.
You are made in the image of God, and in fact, your desires are not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Your desires are good too, and you were made to desire. The problem is, and this ultimately becomes sin, is in our rebellion, we constantly desire the wrong things, thinking that they'll satisfy us, mm-hmm. when in fact they are incapable of satisfying us.
And this leads to the concept of our need for grace,
mm-hmm.
right, by which we are saved.
Right.
Right. But with the Buddhist, Steve, you're actually writing a paper on this right now. So you could probably speak to this a little bit.
I'll just make it quick because we're running short on time here. But I just want to take a few minutes. Yeah. So basically, the paper that I'm writing on comparative religion is basically comparing and contrasting the concept of grace as found in Christianity versus as found in Buddhism. Now, in Buddhism, too, I'm focusing particularly on this one school of thought called Jodo Shinshu school of Pure Land Buddhism in Japan. So what happens is, in the early days of Buddhism, there is a split, right? There is a sect that held strictly to the teachings of Buddha.
That's Theravada.
But then what that meant was you basically had to be a monk if you ever wanted to have a chance of achieving nirvana.
And so, by the way, mm-hmm. just to interject real quick here, a lot of countries, that's what you did. And in fact, it's still used today. So like mm-hmm. in Burma, for example, everyone has to be a monk at some point.
Right.
Even if it's just for a day.
Right.
But exactly right. Mm-hmm. If you want to practice it, you're going to have to become a monk at some point in your life.
So then from there, by about 200 BC, this split happens and there comes along Mahayana Buddhism, and the Mahayana Buddhism.
Let's pause there for a second, because we didn't mention this last time. Let's tell people what that means. It means the greater vehicle. Do you want to tell the parable of the greater vehicle?
I think you do a really good job of that. So
okay, it's been a while since I've read it, but the mm-hmm. parable goes like this: there's a Buddhist monk that comes along. He sees a house that's on fire, and as he sees his house, he sees that there's some children up in the top story of this home, and he wants to save them. Now, he can't go into the house to save them. He needs to try to get those children to come out of the house on their own accord. And so he gets this toy car. Like, so when it's called the greater vehicle, I mean, it really is. It's a vehicle. It's this toy car to play with. And so he's got this toy car, and it's not quite good enough. And this would be Theravada Buddhism. Mm-hmm. It's not quite good enough to convince them to come out of the house. And so he goes and he gets a bigger, better vehicle. This is the greater vehicle, Mahayana Buddhism. And that one is enticing enough to entice the children to come out of the fiery house.
Right. So Mahayana literally means greater vehicle, right? In fact, Mahayana Buddhists call the Theravadas Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle.
And they literally mean vehicle.
Yeah, literally mean vehicle to nirvana, right, basically. Theravadas don't like to use the term Hinayana, although some have adopted that name.
So then you can imagine the Mahayana sees themselves as this greater vehicle in the sense that they can attract people to achieve nirvana because it's more enticing.
Now this was the difference that the Mahayana Buddhism had, was that they opened the possibility of nirvana then to the laity. You didn't have to be a monk. And so then from there, it proceeds. Like in China, Pure Land Buddhism arises, one of the most
prominent figures. So you can start to see how that's more enticing.
Right.
Right? You don't have to become a monk.
And now in Pure Land Buddhism, it is thought that each Buddha, before he or she enters nirvana, they basically create this pure land, this paradise where they will take everybody to. So the laity can devote themselves to these Buddhas, and then the Buddhas, when these people die, the Buddhas will then take them to the pure land, and from there they can achieve nirvana. They can follow the path and things like that. Mm. So you can sort of start to see the progression, right?
Would that be different than a bodhisattva?
A bodhisattva is one, it's basically Buddha to be.
Mm-hmm.
So Amida Buddha, which we'll talk about shortly here, when he was a bodhisattva, his name was Dharmagara, I think. He was still a monk, and he was somebody who was on his way to be a Buddha. So so what basically happens in Pure Land Buddhism then is... you have the paradise that the Buddhas will take people to. So there's this progression. So you have Theravada Buddhism where you have to be a monk, and it becomes less rigorous. Now, in Pure Land Buddhism, they start focusing on this one particular Buddha called Amida Buddha. And the story goes that Amida Buddha, when he was still a bodhisattva, made this 48 vows that, you know... Amida Buddha is a Buddha of compassion, so he was very compassionate for the people that were suffering, and he made these 48 vows. And out of the 48 vows, the 18th vow is called the primal vow. And this vow, basically he said that even if somebody calls on my name 10 times, I will take them to the Pure Land. So so this then gets passed on to Japan. Now, in China, there was this very prominent Pure Land Buddhist called Shantou. And Shantou actually had a disciple, a Japanese disciple called Honen. And Honen took his teachings, took it to Japan, and then Honen has a disciple named Shinran. Now, it is this guy, Shinran, that started the school of thought called Jodo Shinshu. And Shinran's idea of grace sounds very... very similar to what we find in Christianity. So he would say that we are all bound by our evil desires, our blind passions. So even if we wanted to do the good works to attain nirvana, we can't. So what happens is Amida Buddha covers us or embraces us with his compassion, and out of sheer grace takes us to the Pure Land. Because the Amida Buddha has tons of karma, right? So he has the merit that he can pass on to us, right? So does that sound similar? Because Paul taught...
Go ahead. I was going to say it's interesting how adaptive the Buddhism is, and particularly Mahayana Buddhism, and particularly Pure Land Buddhism.
Right.
If you see it practiced here in North America, they meet in churches.
They're even called the Buddha Churches of America.
That's right.
And they have pews.
They have pews. They sing from hymns. Yeah. They have their own Buddhist hymns that they sing.
Buddha loves me, this I know, for the sutra tells me so. Apparently, there's actually...
No, I've been to them. Yeah. Yeah, it's very adaptive.
Mm-hmm. Wow. There is one, I think, in Vancouver, too, if you want to go down there in downtown Eastside. So just to then get to the meat of this really quickly... So then Shenron's view of grace of Amida Buddha looks a lot like what we find in Christianity. So it's unmerited favor, right? Everything's done for you. So when you recite the name of Amida Buddha, it's just a response to what Amida Buddha has already done for you. So I started studying this and comparing and contrasting, and I found this. I found 4 points really quickly. The first is the logical necessity of grace is different. So in Pure Land Buddhism... Even if you're bound by your blind passions, logically speaking, metaphysically speaking, you can still do the works and enter nirvana. Whereas in Christianity, humanity doesn't even have that option. Right? The law was incapable of saving us. You know, all it did was reveal what was inside of us, but the law itself was incapable of saving us. And so grace in Christianity is logically, metaphysically necessary. Mm-hmm. So that's one difference. The second difference is the extent of grace. So in Christianity, the telos, or the end of humanity, is to be with God. So then when God shows us his grace and forgives us of our sins, it brings us right to that point. Whereas in Shenron's view, when Amida Buddha embraces you with his compassion, you are taken to the pure land that he's created, from which you can do the works to get to nirvana. So it's grace plus works in that sense. Thirdly, it's the coherence issue. Again, you know, without the essential self, how do you make sense of karma? And karma actually goes against the idea of grace, right? Because karma is all about cause and effect. You do something wrong, you will suffer for it.
Yeah.
So then when Amida Buddha embraces you with his compassion, what happens to all the bad karma that you've racked up, right? So, and where does it go? So it leaves a lot of things sort of loose ends, not tied up. And finally, and this is probably the biggest one, in Christianity, it starts with humanity being sinners in need of punishment. We're rebels. We need to lay down our arms and we need to receive forgiveness. So this is a moral concept. The grace is foundationally, fundamentally a moral concept, whereas in Buddhism, the problem with humanity is ignorance, and we need enlightenment. In other words, we need improvement, not forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So the type of notion is different. The notion of grace as found in Shenron's Pure Land Buddhism in Jodo Shinshu is a pragmatic one. You want to improve, not be forgiven. So those were the four differences that I've found so far, and now take it with a grain of salt because I'm still, wrapping up my research and whatnot. But it really kind of shook me up a bit when I found out about Shenron and his writings. Not shook me up in a bad way, but it was just like, wow, you know, I didn't know there was something so close to Christianity, right? Christian concept of grace out there. It'd be interesting to look into it,
right? Which a lot of people believe they adopted or got from Christianity.
Yeah, apparently there is some evidence for that, but
well, hopefully that gives people enough to chew on with regards to Buddhism.
So that's lots to think about already. If you have any questions about what we've talked about today or in past podcast episodes, please send us an email either to myself, steve@apologiescanada.com, or to chris@apologiescanada.com. And yeah, thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week.